is my map. I plotted the day's journey on Google Maps and then followed my phone as we rode. Later, this became very helpful when towns would have confusing and winding streets. And even without service, my GPS and map would work, so long as I had loaded it in the morning. Weston rode in front of me. His natural pace was stronger than mine. On a long, straight stretch, he pulled back next to me and wanted to talk. "Think we could get our trip sponsored?" he asked. "By who, like a company?" "Yeah, you're writing about it. I can write about it. And I think a lot of people want to do what we're doing. We could get a bike company or a camping company to give us money." "That's not a bad idea. But how? Do you know anyone?" "I've made pitch decks before, in my New York life. That would be rad." "I thought you didn't believe in money." I smiled as I said it. "It's not that I don't believe in it. I want to dethrone it. Money is a currency like a current. It should flow through me. Savings is stagnant. Feels wrong."
"Sounds like something Jesus would say."
"I mean, that's why I gave all my shit away. Jesus said to the rich man, 'Give it all up and follow me.' Well, here I am. Don't know if I'm following Jesus or just the truth behind what he said."
"Are you calling me Jesus?" I said. We both laughed.
The clouds were fat and lazy on the shore, but sometimes the road would wind into a river valley away from the ocean. The sun would shine just one hill away, and we'd strip off our shirts. My soft white body looked absurd next to Weston's Adonis tan and abs, but for stretches we were alone on these roads, and I felt invisible and free. It was the end of summer, and I'd expected more road trippers, more tourists. But for whatever reason, we often had the road to ourselves. Sweat would build up in my helmet, and upon a certain turn of my head, it would pour out down the bridge of my nose like a faucet. As the sun started to touch the western hills, it was time to watch for a camping spot. I had gotten in my mind that I wanted to sleep under a bridge. It seemed like something Kerouac would have done. The romantic tramps and drifters of the past. It also seemed like a smart move in case it rained. We'd cycled over a few, but I didn't know if we'd come upon one as the sun was setting. I told Weston to keep his eyes peeled for a perfect bridge when the day started dimming. I watched the sun move across the sky and watched the road and looked at the map on my phone and hoped for the best. At one point, I turned my head to see if Weston was still behind me, and he wasn't. I assumed he'd popped a tire or something, so I turned around and backtracked to find him. I couldn't see him. Then I saw his bike, turned over on the side in a hurry. But it didn't look like a crash. Nothing but green bushes flanked the side of the road. Maybe he was peeing. As I pulled up, he was shouting, "These are blackberries!" The exact same bushes had lined the road for 3 hours, but I hadn't looked at them. I was staring at the trees and the sky and the road and the trucks passing by. Apparently, late August is blackberry season in Oregon, and the entire state turns into a ripe banquet. Weston ditched his bike and dove into the berries. The thorns tore at his bare skin, but a jackpot fever had come over him. I gingerly laid my bike down, and for half an hour we ate our fill. The bitter sweetness of the berries stung the inside of our cheeks. Our fingers turned purple. By the time we looked up, the sun was getting low. We laughed at our wilderness sweets and pulled ourselves back to our bikes and got back to riding. I had wanted to get 50 miles in the first day, but we managed only 22. Every mile was a calculation. Okay, so I made it 10 miles in the last hour. So that means if I bike for 3 more hours, that's 30 more miles. That would be 40 miles. Which means tomorrow, if I go 60 miles, then I've gone my first 100 miles. And the whole trip is 10,000 miles, which means I'm 1% done. That's not bad. I do this with everything. If I'm at a party and it's getting late, I calculate exactly how many hours I can sleep if I go to bed in 15 minutes or in an hour. The calculation makes me feel like I'm in control.
Finally, as dusk closed in, we crossed a bridge over a little river that wound through a farm. Weston stopped at the far side of the bridge, laid down his bike, and peered over to a clearing below. I stopped behind him, looked down at the spot, and agreed, this was the place. We pushed our bikes down through weeds and grass till the perfect shelter of the bridge was above us. There were no large trees under the bridge, so the hammocks would have to come another day. We would just sleep on our cheap reflectors on the ground, hopefully around a fire. Time was short. I had to find wood before it was completely dark. Along the river, driftwood had been deposited by flood and tide high on the banks and wedged into trees, messengers of what had been and what would be again. I gathered wood while Weston started our campfire. He loved making the fire, perfecting his little wooden teepee, talking to himself about how he would like to learn how to do it without matches, without a lighter, just friction. I had a small Bluetooth speaker. I put on Van Morrison's Astral Weeks and cleared away shrubs for the campsite. Weston made lentils over the fire, stirred in some spices, and we ate our fill. After biking, even just for an afternoon, all food tasted good. I don't know if we were physically tired or just exhausted from the electric excitement that comes from a long-anticipated launch. We were full, lying by the tiny fire, falling asleep. Astral Weeks played quietly as the embers popped. Then, suddenly, a bright light panned across my eyelids. I sat up like lightning. In the field across the creek was a truck, driving and bouncing through the grass, coming for us. Weston sprung up at the light, too. "Oh, fuck," he said. "They must have seen our fire, dang it." We crouched low, and Weston moved like a ninja to pour his water bottle over the fire. The truck bounced closer, the thick headlight beams flashing in the trees and then across our faces, then in the trees again. We were frozen. "Where the heck will we sleep? Do you think they have guns?" I said. Weston was quiet, watching. The truck got close enough for us to hear music playing inside. The windows were down. Just before it reached the edge of the creek, it made a sharp turn to the left, then kept turning. The headlights sprang around the field and tree line. It kept making the circle. I heard a loud laugh. It was kids doing donuts in the field. They hadn't even seen us. Our cat stance tenseness subsided, and Weston stood up and went to find more wood. The temperature was dropping fast. I shivered in my sleeping bag. Day one was done. The sound of the water. I was under a bridge, tired and full, listening to Van Morrison by a creek. I was doing it. Only 9,978 more miles to go. In the morning, as Weston restarted the fire, I asked how he'd slept. "I didn't," he said. "You didn't sleep at all?" "Maybe 30 minutes. My blanket isn't enough. That was the coldest night I've ever had." "You need a real sleeping bag." "I know." We biked that day through a fine mist to a Walmart, where Weston bought a bulky, cheap sleeping bag. Along the way, the Oregon forest came up to the highway in an impenetrable wall, but we could see that the distant hills had been buzzed bald from logging. I thought about my parents that day, my mom back in Louisiana, agreeing to marry this man and walk across America with him. The first day was probably full of wonder. What an adventure my life is. The second day, perhaps less. Maybe more, what the hell have I done? We camped again that night, on the side of a hill, just hidden from the road by an embankment. We made it close to 50 miles that day and felt very accomplished. Everything on the ground was soaked through. Rotted logs crumbled like cornbread. Fallen branches were slick with moss. The air was like floating rain, suspended and waiting to wet our faces. But Weston kept his singular focus on getting his fire going. He blackened his thumbs with a lighter. He tore pages out of his journal. he blew on tiny bits of damp kindling. Meanwhile, I clumsily tied up my tarp and hammock between two trees. Hammock first, then a string above and my cheap tarp draped across it like a Civil War tent. As soon as Weston got the tiniest fire going, he rolled a joint. I crawled into my hammock to watch, then fell asleep. Biking south the next day, the highway took us up and over one steep hill after another. We biked up inclines slowly and bombed down long drops that would wind us back to the beach, then away, then back. Long, relentless uphills and long, cold downhills in what felt like an eternity of dampness. The next night, we stayed with a woman whose son knew a friend of Weston's in San Diego. She put us up in her guest room, and we gladly showered. We played cards with her and her husband. We told war stories of our incredible 2.5-day journey. They were impressed and worried and excited for us. She heated up the jacuzzi. We soaked for hours, and she brought us beer. In the morning, she called her friend down the coast. "Tina, these two young boys are bicycling from Florence all the way to South America. They stayed with Bill and me last night, and they're just delightful, such sweet boys. Think they could stay with you tonight? Put them up somewhere? They can even camp in your yard." She smiled, put her hand over the phone, and whispered, "She says of course. She says you guys are crazy." We cycled 55 miles the next day, happy to beat our previous day's record. The coast highway took us over steep hills and through small towns and evergreen trees and along cliffs. We reached Tina's house and stayed in her guest room. If this was how the trip would go, people hosting and then calling up their friends down the road, it would be very easy. After Tina, we had our first 60-mile day and reached the coast of California. In just those few days, the trip had begun to feel like our whole life. My theory of waking up my senses and slowing down time was proving true. Those days had stretched into ages, my mind so awake that every foot of every mile was noticed and relished. I kept thinking about my parents. My dad setting out on foot from New York in 1975, curious about what he would see, an America that he would discover for himself. He didn't know that he would meet a girl in Louisiana, that he would marry her, that she would walk with him to Oregon, that they would have three kids and I would be one of them. He had no idea. I bet all he knew was that the trip would change his life, which it did. And all I knew was that my trip might change mine. Chapter 3. The Coast is Clear, Northern California. 13,726 miles to go. In 4 days, we'd biked 160 miles. I was proud. How many people did I know who'd biked 160 miles? But I was also tired and uncomfortable. My knees hurt, which I didn't tell Weston. They hurt bad. This was my fear. What if my body shuts down and I can't even make it to Mexico? Why the holy hell didn't I train? Already, I felt like I'd been living on this bike forever. But the pace of biking, even these few days in, was having the intended effect. Time crawled. Days were eternal. When it would rain, it rained forever. When the sun came out, it would be hot forever. I was a kid again. It was incredible, too, to watch the land change in slow motion. Riding a bicycle gives the land a realistic scale. You notice every seam and crease, the distances between towns and farms, and the height of hills, and the way a road will follow a river or instead cut straight over a hill. You experience it all viscerally. You feel it all fitting together. I appreciated the accurate map my phone gave me. It alleviated the age-old explorer's fear of getting lost. But I knew, even as I cycled south along the familiar Pacific coast, that it cost me something else. It cost me a certain amount of wonder. Not only is every map perfectly drawn, but you can zoom your way into any beach cove in the world and practically steal the margarita out of someone's hand. How do we explore a planet without secrets? I long for the days of lands we didn't know existed, before the uncharted places all disappeared. That's why I love looking at old maps, the ones with misjudged proportions and large sections labeled unknown. A few years back, some scientists were scouring satellite imagery of Mozambique when they noticed a green spot halfway up a mountain that didn't exist on any map. It was the lost forest of Mount Mabu, home to animal species completely unknown to science and forests that had never been logged. No roads, just a thick jungle sitting halfway up a mile-high mountain, the whole thing surrounded by plains. But of course, places like that are the exception today. With the internet connecting us all, the rest of the world feels closer, less alien. But I think that's only true in our minds. The internet does not bring Argentina one inch closer to me than before. That's part of why I craved this trip. Knowledge alone is like an unearned memory, mostly forgotten. Just facts and two-dimensional images. I wanted to physically discover the world the old-fashioned way, to cross over mountains, to see what was on the other side, to hear languages I'd never heard, to take the photographs from National Geographic and put them out in the weather of human imagination. As we entered California, it looked exactly like Oregon, another reminder of the arbitrariness of most human boundaries. The California I was familiar with was urban sprawl, palm trees, strip malls, stucco, and cracked asphalt. But Northern California swaps the rules. At least along the coast, it's all thick and wet with vegetation. Small towns dot the cold forests, feeling far from anywhere. The first town after the border is Smith River, which was falling apart. It was small and seemed to be choking on its modern irrelevance. The paint had chipped from the small houses. The general stores were closed. Whatever reason this town had to spring up in the wilderness, that reason had gone. Just south of this tiny town, Weston's back tire popped. The sidewall blew out, meaning that just patching the tube wouldn't be enough to get us back on the road. We were completely isolated. Our phones had no service. But luckily, we were on the only highway along the coast, so any cars had to go this way. We'd have to hitchhike to the next town. For some reason, hitchhiking embarrassed me. Not the act of hitchhiking itself, but what you have to do it. I stood by the highway, leaning out, trying to make eye contact with drivers as they whizzed by, focusing on trucks and big SUVs because of our bicycles. I had fake reading eyeglasses and put them on to look more approachable. I'd saved up and gotten LASIK surgery before my trip, simply for ease. I was afraid of losing or breaking my glasses somewhere deep in the Amazon and being helpless. But I knew that glasses made me look kinder, softer. And so I put clear lenses in my frames and brought them along, specifically for moments like these. As I stood there, glasses on and smiling big, car after car drove on by. Each passing car felt like a personal rejection. Weston, who had done a lot of hitchhiking before, said the average wait for a ride is an hour. And we have bikes, so it might be longer. Damn, I said. I feel so unwanted. As rejections whizzed by one after another, we had plenty of time to talk. People just don't see hitchhikers anymore, Weston offered. Americans don't have the instinct for it like our parents did. Why do you think that is? Isn't it just dangerous? I thought like every hitchhiker gets raped and murdered, I said. No, not at all. It's probably safer now than it was in the 50s. The only difference is public perception and national news media, he said, taking the tone he gets when he's about to teach something. How so? Back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, everyone was hitchhiking everywhere. My dad hitched from Florida to New York and back a bunch of times. What changed was the news cycle. Back in the day, if someone was hurt or attacked in Maine, the people in Los Angeles never heard a word of it. So the sense of safety was only learned organically. National news made people in Boston fear what was happening in Phoenix. It's the same with people locking their doors in their neighborhoods and not letting their kids play in the woods. It's no more dangerous now, it's just the fear has changed. Well, if we get abducted and put in a bunker underneath an old white guy's house, I'm gonna call bullshit on your theory. I put on my sad baby sloth face, accentuated by my fake reading glasses, and thumbed at a few more cars, feeling a renewed sense of righteousness after Weston's lesson on hitchhiking. It felt so stupid that a perfectly good and environmentally beneficial practice like hitchhiking would disappear because of irrational fear. I smiled and made a please face as a large Suburban passed. Trucks were better, but we had started trying for anything technically big enough to fit our bikes. The Suburban blew past us. I think I might have muttered, "Asshole." But after a few seconds, I turned around and saw that the Suburban, quite a ways down the road, had stopped, turned into a driveway, and was coming back to us. Weston was off in the woods peeing. "Whoa, we caught a big one," I yelled. "Reeling it in now." Weston ran back as the Suburban pulled up just ahead of us at a widening in the road. A woman got out, middle-aged with brown hair matted close to her head from just showering. "You guys don't look like you hitchhike much. That's why I pulled over." "No, ma'am, we don't. We're riding our bicycles to South America and we got a flat tire," Weston said, putting on his theatrical charm. "Oh my God. Well, I can take you to town. There's a Walmart there and I think they got bike parts." "You don't look like the normal people I see on the streets, the gangbangers and crust punks. I'd never pick them up. People aren't trustworthy these days. You never know who's trying to get something from you." She helped us lift the bikes into the back, our gear and bags all disheveled. "Where are you boys from?" "I'm from Los Angeles and Weston's from all over," I said. "Well, I never do this. But you boys look nice, so I decided what the hell, I'll pick you up. Get in." We climbed into the back seat of her Suburban. In the front seat was her daughter. When the girl turned around to look at us, I saw the characteristics of Down syndrome. "This is Lindsay. She don't talk much. She's retarded." "Hi, Lindsay," I said, with the gentle tone that people get when they speak to someone they pity. "Oh, she won't talk to you. She don't talk to strangers. I taught her that. She's real stupid, but I love her. But God, no one prepares you for raising a retarded kid. She's more than anyone can handle. I'd send her back if I could, but she's mine now. I do what I can. Isn't that right, Lindsay?" Lindsay nodded and said nothing. "I swear I don't pick up hitchhikers ever. But you guys look like you needed some help, and you don't look like tweakers, so I thought, what the hell?" She was talking fast to fill the awkwardness of having strangers in her car. She spoke like life owed her everything, but hadn't yet paid her a dime. "You can't trust people on the street around here. People don't got jobs, they're all on meth or some other drug. I've been on disability for 10 years, and I get help from the government for Lindsay. I can't get a job. There aren't none to be had." "Stop picking at your nails," she slapped Lindsay's hands. "God damn it, I told you to stop that." "iPad," Lindsay said. "I told you if you behaved, I'd let you look at the iPad. You can't have it for an hour." Lindsay started wailing. The cry was low and alien and emerged from a sustained breath, like a musical grunt off key. I pushed my knee into Weston's and we gave each other a knowing look. He was watching the mother with half-squinted eyes, probably thinking and placing her into categories. The drive to town took 15 minutes. The woman argued with Lindsay while we sat quietly in the back seat. By the time she dropped us off in Crescent City, Lindsay was whimpering. "Sorry about that," the woman said. "She's just terrible. I don't know what God wants from me." We thanked her for the kindness and got our bikes out of the back. Weston and I didn't talk about it. We felt strange and sad. Crescent City had one main drag and a small harbor. Hills surrounded the town. The Pacific churned beneath beige cliffs. The only bike shop was closed, so Weston had to improvise. He bought duct tape and began masterfully reinforcing his injured tire. There were no tubes of the right size, so he bought one that was too big and folded it into his duct taped mess. "You can fold a tube like that?" I asked. "Yeah, I had to do this before. You just pinch and fold it over itself to make it fit, and then inflate. The pinch will hold. It isn't ideal, but it'll work for a while." I was shaken by my complete ignorance about the workings of a bicycle. I was glad watching Weston troubleshoot, knowing that he could solve any problem. A Walmart employee told us that there was a large bike shop 70 miles south in Arcata, a college town. We'd have to make it there. I stood in the parking lot for a long time while Weston worked his clever magic. As I went to lean my bike on another pole, I noticed a bee sitting on my handlebar, just perched there perfectly still. This wasn't the first time I'd seen a bee. The week before I left, the Time magazine cover story had been "A World Without Bees." The article explained the mysterious hive collapses happening to bee colonies all over the United States. Something was killing them. This was bad news for humans because most of our fruits and nuts are pollinated by bees, and without pollination, there are no fruits or nuts. The article said the bees were dying because of something humans are doing. Perhaps it's pesticides. Perhaps it's our cell phones, or radio waves, or Wi-Fi. No one really knows. When I read this, it hit me that human civilization has managed to get so complex that we cannot trace out the consequences of our actions. So long as the immediate result is what we desire, we're ready to try it. But the threat of long-range danger is harder to feel. The day after I read the Time article, my boss gave me a going-away present. It was a beautiful folding pocket knife with a polished wood handle and a silver blade as clean as a mirror. And at the joint of the blade and the handle was a silver carved bee. I held it in my hand and looked at my boss in astonishment. He said he didn't know anything about the article or that I'd been talking about it. The next day, I was making the rounds to say goodbye to my friends before the bike trip. I met up with a designer friend of mine at a burrito shop. She was waiting for me when I arrived, sketching on a pad. As I walked up, I realized it was a bee. She was designing an album cover for a friend's band, and they wanted a bee. A fucking bee. Now, out on the road, I was seeing bees everywhere. They would land on me and just ride along for miles. I swear. We camped that night, our fifth, in a thicket of blackberries halfway to Arcata, and awoke at 6:30 a.m. at first light. Rain had dripped into our hammocks, and we saw that we'd been sleeping in puddles. Shivering, we packed up our hammocks and bikes, still clumsy at the task but improving. Once our cargo was piled high, we pushed with much grunting back toward the road. My feet slipped in the wet leaves. We dried ourselves the best we could and were blessed by midday sunshine. We rode down to Arcata, the town known for its Victorian houses and famous for its celebration of weed. The many coffee shops and cafes had bright, colorful murals of mushrooms and psychedelic fantasies. We tracked down a well-stocked bike shop and got Weston a proper tire and new tubes. We stayed with a friend of a friend in a crowded college house, and we smoked weed with some well-flanneled college guys. Weston showed me how a gravity bong works in the kitchen sink, using half of a 2-liter Pepsi bottle sawed in two. I took a long hit and felt nothing, but I didn't push my luck. We woke the next day and committed to a full day of riding in the light. We cycled through decently sized towns, which now felt like bustling cities. We finished the day with hours of riding through dark forest and camped again. The next day, it seemed that there was a gas station just a mile down the road, tucked in the tiny dirt patch between the only highway and a wall of evergreens. I needed coffee. We found the Exxon market bustling with people, truckers, passersby, locals, getting their coffee and prepackaged gooey pastries or a decent breakfast wrap for $2.50. Apparently, it was the only business for miles. I got my coffee and sat down in the haphazard seating area in the corner of the gas station. Next to me, an old man hovered over his cup of coffee and a Snickers bar. He wore a dirty, thick plaid flannel shirt with layers underneath and a thick beanie. His pants were brown and dirty. His clothes looked three sizes too big. He wasn't reading or saying anything or looking around. He was only sitting. He reminded me of the kid in high school, forever picked on, who had retreated into his mind, always a time zone away. I drank my coffee and read the news on my phone. I felt him sitting next to me. 10 minutes later, the old man stood up and picked up a bicycle helmet. I hadn't noticed it sitting on the counter next to him. It was pink-trimmed and certainly meant for a preteen girl. He removed his beanie, smoothed out his thin white hair, and strapped on the helmet before walking outside. Through the large windows, I saw him walking up to a child's mountain bike. The neon paint had chipped away, but the remains of a lightning bolt remained. Onto the rusted rack on the back, he had tied a ratty flannel blanket and 2 Gatorade bottles, each half full of water. He adjusted his helmet and rode away. I wondered if he lived in the woods nearby. I wondered if this was his morning routine. We finished our coffees and shitty breakfast food, and I surveyed the map on my phone. We were headed toward the alien world of the redwoods, the giant groves of Northern California, the Guardians. As if the redwoods protected the perfect weather and fertile fields of Central California from a northern invasion. As the Sierras defended her from the east, and the desert defended her from the south. 2 hours into the giant trees, we saw the old man again, pumping up a hill on his tiny bicycle. He stopped as we approached, turned to us, the first time I'd seen his face, and asked, "Which is the best way to get to San Francisco?" I almost didn't hear him. His voice was so small. Weston answered, "The 101 here will take you there, but you should take the Redwood Highway. It's more scenic and has fewer cars. You'll see the turnoff just ahead." "Are there hills?" "I don't know, but probably," Weston said. "Okay." He got back on his bike and continued grinding up the hill toward the turnoff for the Redwood Highway. Weston and I looked at each other. This old man was cycling alone to San Francisco, 250 miles away, and who knows where he'd started. He had no tent, only a blanket, the clothes he was wearing, and a child's helmet on his head. We soon caught up with him, and as we passed, we cheered. "You got this! Woohoo! San Francisco, here we come!" But he didn't seem to notice. A few hours later, we stopped for a break. We were eating snacks and resting in a moment of sunshine when he came riding up and put a leg down. "Well, hello," I said with delight. "I should have stayed on the main road," he mumbled. "Bigger hills. I like bigger hills. This is too flat." "You want the hills? Aren't they too much?" Weston said. "No. No eye contact. I need to get to San Francisco." He climbed back on his bike and left without any more conversation, his little legs pedaling much too quickly, his oversized pants flapping like a joke. We sat there eating granola bars and drinking our water, wondering what was in San Francisco for him. I wonder now if he ever made it. We never saw him again. Riding the Redwood Highway, I felt like a pauper sneaking into the castle. The trees began to tower above us, like a convention of gods, either speaking so far above that we couldn't hear, or waiting for us to leave so they could begin again. We stopped a few times for hours at a time, hiding our bikes behind felled redwoods the size of shipping containers, and traipsing into the forest with our paperback books in search of a reading spot by a stream or in a sunbeam meadow. We found it, and we read. Along the way, the flora and landforms would change magically and suddenly in a fascinating smash-up of microclimates.
Dense forest became a golden hillside, became a clod of oak trees, in the cleavage of two hills, became a rocky cliff down to the sea, all within a few miles of one another. Riding through each, we never tired of wonder, and we loved camping in the woods. The practice of hanging hammocks and unpacking and packing our bikes became quick and easy. The rain stopped. When we pulled away from the ocean, the heat became intense. We bathed in creeks and gas station bathrooms. We stayed with a woman we'd met hours before. We drank beer, and slowly my tailbone stopped aching. As we got closer to the Bay Area, rustic villages and makeshift living transformed into the semi-rural escapes of the wealthy. Second homes, high gates, vineyards, glass castles standing on rocky cliffs commanding the ocean to be beautiful. The coastal roads above San Francisco are some of the most beautiful I've ever seen. Every turn is a bluff, a farm, cows grazing with a view of the ocean. Our individual styles of riding had formed by now. Weston rode in front. Unable to cruise or simply look around, he attacked each mile as though it were a race. He focused on his leg muscles, his form, his speed. I was not like that. I looked around and admired, meandered and felt pangs of love. When we stopped, usually at the crest of long inclines, I asked, "Weston, how amazing was that barn?" "What barn?" "How did you miss it? It was huge and right on the road." "So amazing, falling apart, leaning to its left. I can't believe it's still standing." "I didn't see it." In the evening, we would buy bottles of beer and sit around the campfire and talk. Weston was always talking. "I am pushing myself more each day," he'd say. "I am a student of my own body. If I ride upright with no hands and hold my core constricted, I can work my whole body as I pedal, and if you focus on the glutes, they engage and do the pushing." As we approached the Golden Gate Bridge, so did the fog. It pushed on and around the bridge like milk pouring into coffee, swirling and taking over. When we rode on the giant red structure, we could not see the water below, only gray. Cars would appear out of nowhere and disappear behind us. It was cold. We stopped. We were out of body present, observing ourselves on the bridge as if from outside. As I stared at the bay below, a boat that looked like a spaceship came into view. It was a catamaran, adorned with the word Oracle across its red and white sail. It moved silently, and by watching its wake, I finally grasped how far down the water was. Riding into San Francisco was fun, but ridiculously stressful. We hadn't seen a metropolis yet, and I'd never biked in one. Cars felt like enemies, and we were trespassers in their city on their streets. And the famously steep hills, they are not an exaggeration. For the first time, I had to walk my bike. Weston just powered through. Winding through those streets, I couldn't help but imagine the hills around the bay before the people showed up. How they were once full of shrubs and grass, and now hardly an inch of original nature is left. Almost the entire peninsula is blanketed by cement and bricks and wood and foreign trees and foreign grass. I could feel the heavy human yoke. I found myself wondering, how can the earth hold up all this stuff? We stayed with an old friend of mine for 3 days, and in no time, I slipped back into the comfortable urban life I had enjoyed before the trip started. The comforts of Southern California were all here. Coffee, craft beer, window shopping as we strolled for blocks and blocks. But Weston and I couldn't stay. We were heading into unknown worlds that, perhaps, had none of those things. I would be stripped of what made me feel safe to make room for something else. One morning, Weston checked his email and sat up straight. "Ooh, they want to meet us for coffee." "Who?" I asked. "One of the top guys at Instagram." "Excuse me?" "Yeah, a buddy of mine from my New York days knows him and reached out and said he should meet with us." "Oh my gosh, it's that easy?"
I mean, I guess when you're doing something badass like riding bikes to South America, people will meet with you, Weston said. You sneaky man, setting up meetings. What does this mean? Do they want to sponsor us or something? I'm not sure, but we should meet them now. They're down to meet us at a spot called Trouble Coffee tomorrow. The next morning, we took an Uber to Trouble Coffee, though we debated riding our bikes for effect, but it was across town and too early and too cold. Josh and Matt were there, waiting for us. We didn't know what they looked like, but they had looked us up and spotted us right when we arrived. They ordered us coffee and cinnamon toast, and we sat outside in the misty cold San Francisco air. Nice to meet you guys, Josh said. He was tall, late 20s, and soft-spoken. He was very calm, so calm that he seemed uninterested. He wore a black hoodie and jeans. He was a Silicon Valley heavy hitter and looked exactly as I expected. Matt was a little more animated, but not by much. Tell us about your trip, Josh said, almost inaudibly. Weston and I told them about the excitement of starting out, about my parents walking across America, about camping under bridges, and by the side of the road. At a certain point, I felt like this was a job interview, where they had all the power, and maybe they were humoring us as a favor for a friend and not actually interested. I felt stupid. They almost didn't seem to be listening. I was telling a story from Northern California. So we finally reached the Redwoods, and riding bikes through them is the most... How do you like the cinnamon toast? It's famous in San Francisco. Toast is a thing here, Josh said. Oh yeah, it's really good. I love it, I said. I felt stupid. Why were we here selling ourselves? To get some huge company to feature us? These guys were clearly doing someone I didn't know a favor. They bought us coffee and toast, but I was feeling like a schmuck. I quit telling stories. We talked about the toast some more, about the neighborhood of Outer Sunset, about how the fog was nicknamed Carl, that Carl even had a Twitter account. Well, that was embarrassing, I said when we'd parted. No, it was fine. They're just tech guys. They don't communicate like us. They hated us, I said. We spent one more night in San Francisco and then headed south, past Monterey and Carmel. I had driven Highway 1 many times, and the central coast of California is one of my favorite places in the world. The landscape south of San Francisco quickly transforms from tightly packed city to suburbs to farms and forest. Redwood trees huddle in the moist mountain creases, leaving groves of eucalyptus to climb the drier hillsides. And the little towns on the central coast always send my mind soaring, imagining other lives, ones where I would grow up in the eucalyptus forests building forts. We camped and stayed with friends and acquaintances along the coast, but my real dream was to reach Big Sur, the little town about 2 hours by car south of San Francisco, famous for attracting writers and artists. Jack Kerouac, Henry Miller, Robinson Jeffers. The draw comes from its remoteness and grandeur. A lot of the California coast has cliffs and coves, but Big Sur has giant mountains and no easy ingress or egress. It is remote because it is hard to get to. The cliffs are too steep, the water raging into the rocks. The summits are too high and the canyons too narrow for wide roads. It is a coastal ecosystem separated from the rest of California by the scale of its barriers. Biking through Big Sur means miles and miles high above the water, each foot of pavement delivering you to the best ocean view you've ever seen. Big Sur is also famous for a thick and heavy fog. Some people make the drive from Santa Cruz to Morro Bay and are lucky to see the red taillights of the car in front of them. But if you know Big Sur well, you know that you can almost always beat the fog. You need only go up. Gain some elevation on one of the many switchback roads branching off from Highway 1, and you will find yourself above the blanket, with the sun shining and rolling across the cotton lumps of clouds. The mountains push up from the fog, cooking in the sun and feeding their cold and damp roots at the ocean beneath. On the day we rode up the first inclines into Big Sur, we had hot sun. I felt chosen by God. I had always wanted to camp above McQuay Falls, a waterfall in Big Sur that spills directly onto the beach. It is a thin stream when seen from the designated overlook point, but it's a lot of water, if only one could get below it. There seems to be no way down the cliff to see it up close. Area closed, no trespassing signs lined the other side of the fences down the cliff. Droves of tourists park along Highway 1 and walk to the overlook to take pictures, and it is very difficult to get a spot to camp there. A few of my friends had managed to get a booking, and they said we could crash next to them. Perfect. Again, the serendipity of some of this was not lost on me. It was just like the bees. Was God sending me signs to make me feel safe and good? I don't know, but it felt like it. I had been posting about the trip every day on Instagram, and it was fun to have people follow along virtually. Oh my gosh, you're really doing it. How do you charge your phone? How's your phone working? But the feedback added an element of performance to the trip. I had an audience. So many people were worried about how I charged my phone. This amused me. I would charge it in coffee shops and cafes, of course. It wasn't so hard. But people imagined me in the woods. We camped with our friends above the waterfall, and over beers that night, concocted a plan. We should wake up at dawn and shower in the waterfall, my friend said. We're doing that, Weston said. But Jed, the rule follower, panicked. Oh my gosh, I protested. Y'all, there is no way down. And won't rangers check in the morning? I asked. That's probably like $1,000 ticket. Don't be a baby, my friend said. You're biking to Patagonia. You gotta be bold. We'll go at first light. No chubby ranger is up and checking then. We'll be fine. I'll wake you up. Okay, we'll be up, Weston said. I was nervous about the idea, but fine with being pressured. If we got a ticket, it wouldn't be my fault, and I could say, I told you so. I awoke to my friend leaning over me. Wake up, it's time. Weston and I sprung out of our sleeping bags and headed to the overlook. We climbed down the flaky cliff, sliding and hanging on to ice plants and shrubs. With scrapes and scratches and big rocks giving way, tumbling down and breaking into pieces, we made it down the waterfall. Up close, it looked huge. The water fell in clumps and looked heavy. We stripped naked and got under the water. The illegality of it felt liberating. The naughtiness added to the fun. The water was fresh and cold and clean. It was the best shower you could imagine. Back at the campsite, and feeling refreshed and scandalous, we started packing up. I checked my phone and saw that I had 10,000 new followers on Instagram. What? What was going on? I refreshed. In 1 second, I'd grown another 100. What happened? Wait, did they? I checked my feed, and there it was. A photo I had taken of my bicycle by the ocean. Featured on Instagram's official account. Follow this guy, the message said. He's riding his bike from Oregon to Patagonia and Instagramming the whole thing. Posted 2 hours ago. It had 20,000 likes. Oh my God. Josh and Matt had posted us to 60 million people. Oh my God. They didn't hate us. Weston, they posted. They did? Show me. I showed him the post, and by then it was 21,000 likes. Hell yeah, this is brilliant. I always knew they'd post, he said. You did not. Wow, this is crazy. Like thousands of people we don't know are gonna watch us bike. Is that good? Absolutely, Jed. Think about it. If we have followers from all over, we can ask Instagram for people to stay with in Mexico and South America. People will let us stay with them, Weston said. Oh, wow. That's a great idea. Now that we were going to be watched by thousands of strangers, I felt the affectation of having an audience. I felt that I would speak differently, see things differently. So many people. I began to worry. Would I care more about the post than the actual experience? Would I have to be fake or sanitize my posts? No. My mom already followed me, so I was already censoring myself a bit. Which I think is okay. Saying everything you think or do in public isn't appropriate at a dinner party or online. So that shouldn't be an issue. No, I'm just gonna post what I would post if I were talking to my friends in mixed company. That's effortless and still me. Everything is okay and good, I thought. Then, fuck, I guess I can't get hurt and quit now. The southern part of Big Sur served up wind and dense mist. I had never really feared for my safety on the road, but on the tight turns, chubby-faced white retirees in RVs carved the road up with sharp turns and new rigs. They would slide by so close, my depth perception failed, and I was certain I had passed through them like a ghost. Big Sur ends abruptly in the south. The mountains that guard the land from the sea fall away, and softer green hills make room for cow fields and farmland. We stopped at a pullout where elephant seals congregated on the beach, and a parking lot had been erected for tourists to stop and stare at these obese wonders. I leaned on the wooden fence to stare at the massive seals below. Most of them were sleeping, and a few were hump-flopping their way across the beach. None seemed to be in the water. A huge male, with his disgustingly spongy nose, was chasing a smaller male across the beach. Back on the bikes, evening came on faster than it seemed it should have. We passed Hearst Castle, high on the Golden Hills to our left, and grabbed dinner at an overpriced diner. I ate chicken chimichangas, which will be important to know later, and was miserably full. We stopped at a gas station to buy some water and toilet paper for our imminent camping. Parked just outside was another touring bike, with a trailer hitched to the back. When I looked at it more closely, I realized it wasn't actually a trailer, but a kid's seat that gets pulled behind. The seat held a big, overflowing backpack that was so overfilled that bungee cords strained to hold the contents together. Weston had already found the rider and was talking to him. His name was Johnny Jones. He was very tan and overweight and had bad teeth and a huge smile. He had no hair but wore a bandana on his head. He looked almost Samoan, like a giant baby. I went inside and bought some supplies. I returned to my bike and passed Weston and Johnny, chatting away, entering the gas station. I packed my panniers with snacks and water and toilet paper. After some time, Weston came up to me holding a lunch bag. "Where'd you get that? Is that food?" I said. "Johnny gave it to me." He opened it up, and it was absolutely full of weed. "Whoa," I said. "He is traveling the country by bicycle as a way to deal with his depression. He said, who can be sat on a bike? He talks to offices and construction sites and asks for $1 donations. He used to be on all kinds of meds and prescription shit and gave it all up for the bike. After he told me his story, I offered to buy him a Gatorade. I don't even really have money for Gatorade, but I just felt like doing something nice for this guy. His story is amazing. Let whatever money I have flow through me. So I bought it for him, and he said he wanted to repay me, and dug this out of his bag and gave it all to me. He said weed is real medicine, not that man-made crap. Holy shit. It was so much weed. You're gonna die from that, I said. I know. I'm so excited. Feels like a sign from the universe, from God. I think Johnny Jones was an angel. And he has your same initials. Wow. Just south of the gas station, we found a campground in the small tourist outpost that exists only to serve Hearst Castle. The campground wasn't full, and there was no one at the entrance, so we rode in and set up shop in a far corner spot, hoping we could wake at sunrise and be out of there without paying. As the sun set, We threw our bikes down, hung our hammocks, and walked out at twilight to the beach. We sat on the sand and listened to the waves. Weston pulled out his rolling papers and an enormous handful of weed.
Jed, you don't like weed, right?
No, it makes me sick.
Come on. Tonight, on this beach, in this place, it's worth giving it another try.
You always say you're waiting for the right moment. What if tonight is the right moment? Weston said.
I'll admit, I believe in giving things multiple tries and not holding a person or an experience or a thing to one bad memory, or three, especially things that people love. And the trip itself had an exploratory spirit about it. What was a bike trip like this for if not trying things, saying yes to anything?
Okay, I said finally, but I'm not going to smoke much, just enough to feel something.
Weston seemed to inflate with triumph. Smiling, he rolled a very fat joint, lit it, and took a long drag. He passed it to me.
Wait, so what is the proper way? I asked.
Pull in the smoke and hold it for as long as you can. Deep in your lungs. Let it go all the way to the bottom. You'll probably cough, but that's okay, Weston said.
I inhaled deep, held it, and coughed.
Good, okay, puff, puff, pass. Weston reached for it and took another long toke. Johnny said this weed was given to him in Humboldt County and was grown outdoors, so it's more harsh than the candy-looking medical-grade stuff you see in dispensaries. But it's good, you'll be good.
He would speak with that flattened stoner voice that comes from holding your palate closed as you let the smoke sit in your lungs. I didn't feel anything.
Here, let me try again. I reached for it and inhaled again. I held it in and only made the smallest chirp of a cough.
Okay, I think that's enough, I said.
Well, maybe one more, then you're done.
I wasn't feeling anything, so I took another long, large pull. Then Weston finished it off for several puffs. I studied my feelings to see if anything was happening.
Weston began doing yoga in the almost darkness.
Just feel your body, he said. Every inch, just move slowly.
By now, I was definitely feeling something. My head felt like it was filling with water or jelly, and my eyes would drag the image when I turned my head. My arms began to feel very heavy.
This was it. It was happening.
Quick, do yoga, I thought. I am remarkably inflexible. So yoga meant waving my arms around repeatedly and bending over ever so slightly. My mouth became very dry, so dry I thought something was wrong. I don't know how long we sat there, Weston doing yoga, me pretending to be okay while overanalyzing everything happening to me. When I stood up, I felt like the connection to my body had a satellite delay. I was sinking. It was like trying to walk on the bottom of a pool. My stomach began to ache. How could this be what everyone loves about being high? I was not relaxed, or giggly, or hungry. I thought my mouth was going to crack off. My whole body felt like cement.
I'll be right back. I have to use the bathroom, I said.
My stomach hurt. It was such an odd feeling, a pressure in my gut, a knot, an ache. If I sit on the toilet, maybe something will happen and it'll help. I stumbled through the campground of the bathroom, which was a cinder block structure with 6 or 7 doors all in a row, each stall with its own mirror and sink. My stomach felt bloated, like maybe I'd swallowed a baby. Maybe the chicken chimichangas I had eaten earlier at the overpriced tourist restaurant near Hearst Castle were bad. Maybe getting high screws with your digestion. I wished Weston had come with me to the bathroom so I could ask him which one was the culprit. I thought if I took a shit, the pressure would go away and maybe the high too, so I pulled my pants down around my ankles and sat on the toilet. I was breathing heavy and strange, slow, long breaths, like a woman giving birth. Nothing was happening. I looked around the room, trying to count how many white-painted cinder blocks were stacked from floor to ceiling. I pushed to try to make something happen. Nothing. Even sitting there with my pants down, my arms folded in my lap, my body hunched over, my stomach wasn't improving. It was getting worse.
I felt the pressure in my stomach expand, grow, and suddenly my saliva was warm and flowing. Oh, God. I lunged forward, still sitting, and threw up on the floor in front of me, into my underwear, all over my shoes and shins and bare knees.